Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Shindig, an archaeology podcast brought to you by the Red River Archaeology Group. I'm your host, Dr. Tom Horn, and I'm joined by producer extraordinaire and my co-host, Luke Barry.
An all-round lovable guy, Luke Barry.
That's
my full title.
That is what it says in your website entry. But you wrote it. You wrote it, I think, Luke.
I took a poll first. I didn't just make this.
Was the poll in your household going to be?
It was my child, and that's all.
Did you buy that vote? Did you buy that
I
vote?
I did. I had to give her at least 4 cookies to get that statement.
Today's episode is based on homes as well, based on households. So I think I brought that around.
We knew what we were doing. That was great. That was a great link.
We had the absolutely brilliant, and I don't say brilliant lightly, with Dr. Mm-hmm. Rebecca Boyd. We were discussing her amazing new book, Exploring Ireland's Viking Age Towns, Houses and Homes. And it's great. You should buy it. There's a book launch coming up relatively soon, and we'll get the details for you at the end of the podcast. It tells us, it's working towards a new methodology for how to look at the domestic space in the Viking Age, and this new phenomenon of towns, urban centres, that really the Vikings are bringing, the Irish before that aren't living in towns or nucleated settlements in the way that we would understand them as towns. There are groups of people obviously living together, but you know, the town is more as we understand it today. That's kind of the Vikings and the Viking Age. And yeah, it was fantastic. You know, it's not just the house, the structure, it's the social space that it is, it's how people move through it, it's how your guests move through it. I love this. It was genuinely enlightening, and I think you thought the same, Luke.
Yeah, I loved it, and like I have the opportunity with these podcasts that I have to go through and edit them, so I effectively listen to these and see these 4 or 5 times, and this was one of those ones that every time I went back to do an edit, I was learning something new. Like, Rebecca is a phenomenal speaker. She knows exactly what she's talking about. She's full of knowledge. And as I say, there's so much to take from this podcast. So hopefully you'll enjoy it, because we definitely did.
So I suppose the first question I'd like to ask, certainly, and Luke will follow up, but I just really want to ask, what is household archaeology, in the sense that it's not a necessarily new period of study, but I think the term is newer than that. And it would just be, I think, good for our listeners just to sort of understand essentially what it is you do. So if you could just explain briefly what household archaeology is and your area of study.
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, the household itself, right? The household is the group of people who live under the same roof, live in a house. And we generally think of that as being like parents and children, the nuclear family kind of model. But there's loads of different types of households. So you could have, say, for example, you could have a monastic household, you know, a group of monks living together. You know, they're all the same gender, but still living under the same household and kind of bound by the same rules and the same kind of, you know, all connected by the same relationships. So it's this group of people who live together. And household archaeology kind of, it takes that that group of people as being the basic social unit. So the unit around which everything else is organized and everything else is functions. And it goes into, we go into the archaeological data to look for evidence of how that household was formed and maintained through time. So for example, we look at, we could look for artifacts that tell us about work practices and the production of objects. So look at where they're found in the house, or if they're found outside of the house, and tell us that, see what that can tell us about how people were working together with each other or away from each other and moving around spaces.
Yeah, no, that really does help. Because there is a really good line in your book when you're talking about like assemblages and networks of connections. And that's something normally in archaeology we think of on a macro scale, you know, the stuff that I will look at with silver, sort of particular coins that are moved around. And I'm thinking, you know, you're thinking like across the whole of sort of Northern Europe and Central Asia sort of thing. But you're essentially taking the way that we look at archaeology, but focusing that on a household. So in you know, when people are maybe looking at a site of like a couple of hectares, you're looking at that the floor plan of a house, really, but you're kind of taking all those same techniques and applying it to that. So maybe you can see where someone has been sitting and doing some crafts work, because there's maybe bits of detritus coming from that. Is that a correct way of looking at it?
Yeah, I think that's a really nice way of looking at, actually. And I hadn't made that connection. I hadn't made that little leap. But yeah, it's really about looking for the networks and the connections between people, but at this tiny, tiny scale. And then we can use that to build up, you know, to, in the context of the town, we can build up to, from the individual household to all the households together on the street and looking at how they connect together. And then again, up to the bigger level of the town itself and the whole community. So yeah, I think that's a lovely way to think of it.
Thank you very much, Luke. See, definitely keep that part in.
Don't edit that out, please.
But that's just, I mean, I'll Luke's going to come in, I think, after this question, but you're talking about, that's great. A great way to move on is talking about how the house sits in the sort of the wider context. And we're specifically in your research is talking about how it sits within a town or an urban context. And you say, I think right at the start of your book as well, that sort of Ireland and probably everywhere else needs a sort of new archaeology of urbanism. So why does your area of expertise, Viking Age Ireland, why does that need a new archaeology of urbanism, like a way that we can understand a Viking Age town better?
Yeah. And also, what is an archaeology of urbanism?
Exactly. Let's go right back to the basics again. So what is an archaeology of urbanism? Well, urbanism is towns and how towns develop and grow and how the people within towns develop, grow, react to each other and to this environment that they live in, and the environment of a town. If you think about it, you know, towns are really closely knit. There's people all together all the time, connecting, interacting, moving around. So there's loads, they're really busy, and there's loads of things going on. And you contrast that to, say, your typical Irish ring fort, which is out in the middle of the countryside. You could have another ring fort or settlement, you know, a couple of hundred metres away, but it could be a couple of kilometres away. So there's real contrast in the way in which people relate to each other in urban places and towns and to the countryside. And like, we can all relate to that today. I'm from the side of the Wicklow Mountains, like right up on top of the mountains from my parents' house. You can't see the lights of another house at nighttime. It's really isolated, really quiet. And then when you go from that to, say, the middle of Dublin today, it's a completely different experience. And towns are increasingly, towns have always been important, but we're becoming more and more important. As we all know today, so many more people live in towns and cities and urban places. Here in Ireland, towns have always been seen as other, as different. You know, we have a very fractious and contested relationship with our urban history, largely thanks to British colonialism and, you know, the seat of empire and all that, and a very difficult relationship. And that fed down through the early years of research on towns through the 1950s, 60s, were all about making sure that Ireland's heritage, Ireland's past, was a source of national pride and glory, you know. And there's some really nice quotes from, well, they're perhaps not really nice quotes, but there are some quotes from work in the 1960s saying that the natural preserve, I'm going to get this quote wrong now, but the natural place for an Irishman is in the countryside.
That's, yeah, I like that.
And not in the town, that towns are foreign, they're the preserve of aliens, they're different and they're other. So that viewpoint kind of permeated, I think has permeated a lot of research, and maybe how research has stalled into the archaeology of Ireland's towns. So that's kind of the background context to it. So why do we need a new archaeology of towns, a new archaeology of Ireland's Viking towns? Because I think towns are really, really important. Because firstly, we have done a huge amount of archaeological excavation in these towns, in urban places, a vast amount of excavation, a vast amount of investment into that, into creating that archive of material. And as we know, archaeology is not a renewable resource. We're going to run out of archaeology. So we need to, and we can't keep digging. So we need to ensure that we're investing into that back catalogue of data, the data that we've already created through the last 50 years of excavation in Waterford, in Cork, and in Dublin. And we need to make sure that we get maximum value out of that archive, because it's about respecting the material that we have, the investment, the hours of work that have all gone into creating that archive. So archaeology as a resource to work with, archaeology as something that's really important. And I feel like I'm really rambling here now, and we're going to have to edit this bit.
No, this is all good.
But the third strand of what I was going to go for there is that since our first Viking archaeology was excavated in the 1960s in Dublin by the National Museum up around Christchurch and High Street. Mm-hmm. And if you just think of how far we've come since the 1960s, the amount of new angles, new investigative angles, new analyses, new approaches that we could take, both in terms of the physical investigation that we could do, the new scientific methods that we could use to examine the record that we have, but also the different theoretical angles that we can take. So we need to move away from the idea of towns being this colonial relic or preserved foreign alien to really integrating towns into, and the archaeology of towns into our narrative again. So like I said, the first archaeology was excavated in the 1960s. And then, of course, in the 1970s, we had Wood Quay and everything that went along with that. That really showed the strength of attachment to our Viking heritage here in Ireland, to our Viking past. And if you go to Fáilte Ireland or to Ireland's Ancient East, to the tourist boards, that heritage, that Viking heritage, that medieval heritage really grounds a lot of the work that they do. So we have people coming to Ireland to investigate our Viking heritage. Like the success of Dublinia and Waterford's Viking Triangle are huge. So again, it's about valuing that heritage and creating new ways to investigate, to look at and to explore that, and making sure that that is valued, that we place enough value on that heritage so that the visitors who come here, that they see that value.
That's brilliant. And I'm just going to jump in just for, yeah, and Luke's got the next question, but it's really fascinating. You're talking about the colonial aspect of things. I think it's really interesting that it's funny in Scotland, we obviously a different situation, but we kind of don't, given that I suppose the Vikings come in and take a lot of land and are there for a really long time up until, the 15th century and arguably kind of later in places. Mm-hmm. But again, it's used by the tourist board and we all are really sort of into it as well. But we've never kind of had that conversation about, I suppose it's a colonial movement as well. And I know from my work in what sort of Eastern Europe that in the Soviet era, they had the Normanist and anti-Normanist. So there's this idea of colonialism and, Germanic peoples, Anglo-Saxons or Scandinavians moving in and setting up something. And then people in this more modern times have a kind of difficulty, dealing with that in terms of it's a colonial sort of imposition, but it's part now of our shared history. And obviously what's happening in Ukraine at the moment is part of that as well. So it's something that, you know, is part of our everyday. And the, as you say, the cities in Ireland now, many of them have this sort of Scandinavian sort of impetus, at least to start them. And your research is very interesting for talking about how that's actually very much a hybrid thing between the sort of Irish people and incoming Scandinavians. But I'll stop talking now as well, and I'll let Luke have a go.
I guess I have two questions. One is I have an interest myself in Irish place names, because they changed so often throughout history, really, for lots of different reasons. Does that become an issue when you're trying to, I guess, catalogue towns in Ireland and stuff like that, and the histories that took place there? Like, you have Cove, I'm from, for example, which was Cove, C-O-V-E, then becoming Queenstown, then becoming Cove again, which is C-O-B-H, which actually doesn't mean anything in Irish. Which is an interesting change. So like, when you have these, I guess my question is, does it become difficult to catalogue the history of these towns when they underwent so many changes?
Yeah. There's loads of work done on place names in Ireland and looking at those changes and how they changed. There's a great project based in UCC trying to catalogue the entirety of Irish place names.
Oh, wow.
But actually what that kind of kicks off in my mind actually is, the difference between Ireland and Scotland and Ireland and the UK in terms of Viking place names. In the UK, there's a huge number of Viking-influenced place names, vast numbers of them. And here we have about 20 place names with Viking element in them. And Fota is one of them. Fosie. There's also Keyser Street in Cork City Centre. And Leekslip is supposed to be
salmon, isn't it? Lex, those places like Lex, Lax and things we get in Scotland, from the Old Norse for salmon,
But there are only about 20 of them here in Ireland. So that tells us a lot in terms of what we're missing. And the relationships between the place names and the people who were living there. So if we only have, one of the arguments would be, if we only have a few Viking influenced place names, right, were the Vikings really having that much of an impact on the wider landscape? Mm. This feeds back to why we think about Vikings as being urban, as being based in towns, because we have so few place names. Because to change a place's place name, you know, you have to be using the place name all the time for it to kind of rub off into your mind, your households, your communities, and then the wider community's mind to kind of to affect that change.
Hmm.
That's really interesting, because, I mean, I think I'll pay a little homage to our dear colleague who passed recently, Ryan Foster, but he studied Sheeling names in Cumbria. And a lot of them are actually... is there an argument to be made with his research that there's probably more Hiberno-Scandinavian place names in Cumbria than there are in many ways in Ireland? Because basically, look, what happens is that the kind of the high hegians, as we say in Scottish, the kind of elite seem to get kicked out of Dublin between about 902 and 917. And we'll get into that later on. But where do they go? They seem to go to sort of Isle of Man, Galloway, which is like Foreign Gales as well, which is a whole other podcast about that, but in Cumbria as well. And what they seem to do there is they do sort of transhumans, they do sort of farming, sort of upland and winter and summer farming. But the names that they're using, because they're coming from an Irish background, is they're kind of taking Gaelic words and combining them with Old Norse, and then they're putting them on what is now an English landscape. So that's really fascinating, that point that Luke's question led into there and Rebecca's answer that, you know, that's a good question. Are there more Hiberno-Scandinavian place names in England than there are in Ireland? Yeah. I'll shut up now. But
okay.
I think I'll let Luke go again. But I think, that's really interesting.
But I suppose to take it off in a different direction, the question is, I guess, what role does developer-led archaeology play in your research?
A huge role.
Okay.
A massive role. So if you come at it from the... let's use the perspective of finances again. It costs a huge amount of money to excavate an urban site.
Mm.
First of all, to acquire the land, you know, in the middle of Dublin city centre, to put everything together in place for a development, and then to get the archaeological campaign underway. And then, of course, all the post-ex commitment ongoing post-tax commitment, because we know that these sites are going to produce waterlogged deposits. We know that they're going to produce vast quantities of organic material, and the costs of curating that material for 20, 30, 40 years down the line are huge. So we are rarely, if ever, going to see a university unit, a university-led campaign in the one of these urban situations. So the only people who are ever going to excavate Viking Age Dublin are commercial archaeologists, are developer-led archaeologists. And I think that Dublin has probably the highest level of Viking Age excavated Viking Age archaeology across the entire Viking world. It's a huge amount of work going on and retrieved a huge amount of archaeology. So developer-led archaeology is absolutely vital. Without it, we wouldn't know anything. We wouldn't know any of this. We wouldn't have any of these deposits. So it's really important to me to kind of to recognize that and to kind of put forward that the importance of that archaeology. And it kind of brings out the level of skill of the people who've excavated that. Mm. It's huge. These are really tricky deposits to excavate. It's really difficult archaeology. And we're very fortunate that the kind of the core teams of people who've been excavating this over the past 30 years have kind of stayed much the same. So the same people have been excavating these sites from the 80s, 90s, right through to now. So there's a huge wealth of knowledge in their kind of collective institutional knowledge in the commercial companies. And I think we really need to value that and to put more kind of emphasis on that skill. It's not something that is hugely well represented in kind of academic posts here in Ireland. We don't really have that many people with a specialism in kind of in developer-led archaeology in urban contexts. It's something that's a little bit, I think it's a bit lacking perhaps here. But
just the thought of that, yeah. Now, wasn't there like a Hiberno-Scandinavian house under a Lidl? Was it a Lidl, yes, in Dublin?
Is that, yes, you? There is. Yeah.
Could you tell us,
yeah,
a little bit about that? It's just, I just suddenly got into my head again.
Yeah. So this is a great site on Ainger Street in Dublin. It's outside the city wall. So it's a little bit away from kind of Christchurch Cathedral, Woodquay, that kind of part of town. So the preservation, it's a little bit drier up there. So the preservation wasn't amazing. But this was a house excavated by my colleague Paul Duffy in IAC archaeology about 6 or 7 years ago. And it was, like you say, it was in advance of a supermarket construction there. And the city archaeologist and Dr. Ruth Johnson and Paul Duffy and the whole team got together. And they, when they found these deposits, so there were overlying layers of kind of, you know, later medieval, post-medieval material. And then at the very bottom of this really odd example of a sunken floored building. It's not very big. It's stone constructed. It's got an entrance kind of passageway leading down into the ground. And the floor then would have been sunken down, you know, I think it's about 60 centimetres down, possibly a little bit more. There's a lovely reconstruction drawing of this, actually. So it is just this little house, this little snippet of a house from outside the city walls. And yeah, you can go and visit, do your local shopping, do your weekly shopping, go visit your local Aldi or Lidl, and look at it preserved underneath this glass floor. It's just a lovely example of showing what was there. And letting people relate to it by just making sure that that is on display and visible. Mm.
Lidl's and Aldi's have kind of given us a lot of interesting archaeology, haven't they?
Yeah.
You mentioned houses there and stuff. What do houses and homes tell us about the daily lives of the people living in them, the people dying in them, people just, yeah, existing in them,
existing.
Guess.
Well, I think they tell us everything, virtually everything. I mean, if you think to your own home, how much does it reflect you as a person?
Yeah.
Your home, your family, what you need, what you want, what you don't want. as much as anything.
That's a good point. So what you don't find, is that as interesting as what you do find in these places? Yeah.
Yeah. Absence is as exciting as the presence, I think. Yeah. What we don't have. So houses are like, you know, they're just so personal to us. Personal to us today. And I think they always were. And when we come to our Viking Age towns, I think they become even more so, because we're talking about one of the definitions of a town is that the population are non-agricultural in terms of what they do. So they're not, their primary purpose is not to produce food. Of course, making food, securing food is a huge part of everyone's daily life. But when we come to a town, you're not actively going out and spending your days tending to fields full of crops or animals. And I think that has a really significant shift in terms of the household organization and in terms of where people are all the time. And in here, in these houses, people are at home all the time. They're making stuff, they're doing stuff, but they're all physically within and around the same space most of the time. You know, we don't have office buildings. We don't have pubs. We don't have cafes. We don't have, you know, all these, I suppose, what we think of as functional third spaces, maybe. You know, it's not the home. It's not the place of work, you know, but you go to the, we don't go to, there aren't shopping centres. There aren't places to go to hang out. It's all centred, all activity is centred in and around the house, in and around the home. So the house, it tells us so much about people's relationships to each other, as we'd said at the start, because that's what a household is. It's all about the relationships, but also about the relationships to their work, to what they do, to their neighbours, to their communities, because it's everything is centred in the house and the home. There aren't other places to go. So everything is at home, takes place at home, around the home, whether that's your home, your neighbour's home, your family home. But everything comes right back here to this personal space where you live, where you construct all your, all those relationships, where you construct your daily life, where you go to get away from everyone, to get away from daily life, to get away from the neighbors who annoy you, your uncle who said something mean to you. You know, it all comes back to the house. And I think we look at the houses in terms of that, in terms of how people behaved, how people related to each other, and what that can tell us about the world in which they live.
You've told us about the sort of importance of, you know, the house. I think we're all a bit more used to it with working from home, you know, that we're kind of used to having that, you know, you're working, your partner's upstairs or downstairs, and you're working in the living room, as I am here. So I think maybe 5 years ago, people would be a bit like, I can't really, this doesn't make sense for urban dwellers, for sure. But from that, then I want to sort of look at the house and then how you approach it as an archaeologist, and maybe tell us how you look at things in terms of different zones and patterns that you see and what survives archaeologically. You know, is there an example like as we see even today, you'll see a worn set of stone steps. You'll see, oh, people have walked up and down this. You can see, you know, sort of decades or hundreds of years of footsteps. How does that work in terms of your work? What patterns are you seeing? And do you see little things like that, sort of worn flagstones and different areas that have been used for different activities?
Yeah. Okay. So in terms of how I've looked at these houses, because this is developer-led archaeology, so the trenches are just put where the trenches need to be for the excavator. So that means that we get a really wide range of houses. So we have the beautiful complete houses from places like Woodkey, Templebar West, where we have like 100% of the floor plan, and we can see the different, you know, the different walls inside the houses, the different types of floors, the hearths, and they're wonderful, right? They are absolutely beautiful pieces of archaeology, pieces of housing. But we also have just bits of other houses that were located on the edge of the excavation trench, or, you know, we have a bit of a wall, part of a corner or a doorway. So there's a huge variability in the evidence from these wonderful houses to just bits and pieces that on their own make very little sense. But because we have so many of these houses, so there's over 490 excavated Viking Age houses from Dublin, Cork, Waterford and Wexford. It's really big data set. So when I was looking at these, I wanted to make sure to try and include as many as possible and as much information as possible to just really respect that range of data. So I looked at them, at all these houses, kind of from using a couple of different methodologies. So first of all, I did a very basic comparison, you know, comparison of architectural features. How big are the houses? What way are they oriented? What's found inside of them? How many of them have hearths? How many have bedding areas, or what sort of types of floors are present in different parts of the house? And I tried to pull that out across that range of 490 houses as much as possible. So we can talk about kind of the breadth of what is one of Ireland's Viking Age houses. What does one of these houses actually look like? But then because we have these really beautifully preserved houses, I wanted to really to find a way to look in the detail there as well, into the detail of those. So I used two other methodologies. One is access analysis, which is looking at how people moved in and around spaces, looking at the presence of doorways or barriers to movement, and really trying to think about how you'd walk in and around, how you'd experience one of these houses, you know, from the perspective of the person living inside the house, and also from the perspective of a visitor. So trying to take two different standpoints, two different viewpoints there. And I was also really, really fortunate that I was given access by Pat Wallace, who excavated the Wood Quay site, to some of the material from Fishamble Street. So he let me do artifact distribution analysis from 9 houses on Fishamble Street. So artifact distribution is literally, as it says, the distribution of artifacts. Imagine that. So it's looking at what artifacts were found where, in which houses. Mm. So I looked at 9 houses and I was able to pinpoint where in the house different artifacts came from, whether it was from a bed, from a bedding area, from a seating area, from the hearth, from the doorway, or from just a generic house context, which on their own aren't terribly helpful when something just comes from the house. But I was able to pinpoint into much greater detail exactly what was found inside these 9 buildings, where they came from. So just to go back to the idea of work practices, something that I found that I wasn't expecting to find was that there were 2 of the houses had distributions of craft debris in the corners of the houses. So the craft debris, I think one was from amber and one was from bone working. And these were just from the corners, just inside the doors of the houses. And I was actually a bit surprised by this, because everyone had always talked about the corners of the houses being kind of almost negative spaces, you know, not really used for anything. They're in the corners, they're a bit further away from the hearth, a bit further away from the only light source within the house. And everyone kind of thought, do you know, we just put stuff there. But looking at the artifact distribution showed that actually in these 2 houses, at least, these are active working spaces where people were sitting and carving amber or carving bone artifacts, bone items, things to use. And around the same time, I was also talking to some reenactors from Viking Age houses in Denmark and in Scandinavia. And they were not at all surprised by this. They said, well, of course, because if you sit beside the door, that's where you get the natural light.
Oh, yeah.
And ideally, they said that they would work outside because that's the best natural light. But if it was a very wet, miserable day like today, you know, where you sit inside the house to do your work is inside the doorway, because that's still the best natural light coming in. It's not around the hearth. It's not in the middle of the house. It's at the edge where the natural light is coming in.
That's why I chose this desk, because I have a window right here.
You have the window there. Yeah, same. Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, daylight just brightens your mood.
Yeah.
You know, it is better. And if you're doing fine, detailed work, you know, you need the light to do that. So that's kind of one example of where this comes in. I should probably explain a little bit about what a Viking Age house looks like.
Yeah.
What one of these houses look like. Because I was talking there about corners. And the reason corners are really important is because Viking Age houses, these Scandinavian Dublin urban houses, are rectangular. And that's very different to Irish houses because they're round, round houses. And one of the key, something that I often ask like first year students or second year students, what's the difference between a round house and a rectangular house? And the difference is corners. Because if you think about it, you have your hearth in the middle of a round house. All the spaces are equidistant from the hearth. Every space gets the same amount of light, same amount of heat, kind of same amount of, you know, emphasis from the hearth. But in a rectangular house, the hearth in the center doesn't have that same impact. You know, you have spaces that are going to be further away, physically further away from the heat and from the light. So you have this, you create these darker, colder corners, spaces further away from the hearth. You know, and you could perceive those as being lesser, as being negative spaces, as being deliberately, you know, or conceptually removed from the hearth. But looking at the artifact distribution showed that actually these are still functional spaces and they're close to the doorway, to the natural light, and equal, implying that the natural light is equally as important as the light from the hearth. So it's about kind of, so that kind of brought me to kind of, I suppose, questioning assumptions about what makes a house different. What's the difference between a rectangular Viking house and a round house?
And I think that's, Luke's, because I know Luke's got some questions about Ireland, because I'll just focus completely, if you let me, on Viking towns. But Luke's got some.
I have two questions there. I have one question. This might be a stupid question, but it just came into my head. Does the shape of a house change the shape of the things within it? Like, as in you'd have, if I look at a modern house now, for example, and how a kitchen would be fitted to a square house to have angles and stuff, from a round house to a rectangular house, does it change the contents within?
That's a really good question.
Good.
It is actually a really good question, okay, for a couple of reasons. So first of all, what's inside the house is generally very little stuff. You know, we don't, to use the example of kitchens, we don't have fitted built-in kitchens, unfortunately, or fortunately. What we do have is we have the bedding areas, you know, the aisle areas around the edges of the house. And we have these in round houses as well at Deer Park Farms. You know, we have compartments of, they're built little post and wattle walls around the inside. They're filled with soft bedding material, with twigs, with grass, with straw, moss. And we have those in the Viking houses as well. Okay, so we have the same bedding areas. We can have different areas of kind of paving within them, stone paving, timber paving, wattle mats used as paving. I suppose what it does change, is the roof structure. And from what we understand, most round houses were built. So these houses are all built of post and wattle. So like your wicker weaving, like a wicker picnic basket, but just on a grander scale. So what we understand from houses like Deer Park Farms is that the roof structure, it continues in. So the wattle walls are built up, but then they bend in at the top to create kind of like an upturned basket shape. So there's no freestanding internal roof supporting posts. The weight is all supported on the walls of the house. Okay, and that's possible, you know, because of the dynamics of it being a round shape. You build it around the door, the jambs and the threshold, and that's an integral part of the shape and the construction of these round houses. But what changes in the rectangular houses is that because they're long, you know, they're not the same shape, we have to have freestanding internal roof supporting posts. So it's that classic four aisle division, those classic four posts inside the house that gives us that aisled division. And that's the change in what's inside the house.
Okay. So
we still have our walls, our door. We still have the hearth in the middle of the house, but the rest of the space is shaped around these four roof supporting posts, these four big posts that kind of, they dominate the inside of the house. They create that three-aisled layout that is typical of these rectangular houses. And of course, the other change is the doorways. So in a roundhouse, we only have one doorway. But in these rectangular houses, we have two doorways. And they're placed in the end walls, in the shorter end walls. So you have this through kind of this, you can literally look right through the house from one door out the other door. And you have the hearth in the middle of that passage, in the middle of the four roof supporting posts. So that would be the other big change, the doorways. And that tells us, that can tell us a lot about the ways to move through and obviously to move through the space. But in terms, you could start thinking about visual access, about whether doors open or closed, whether it's because of the weather or the wind, or are there other reasons for opening or closing doors?
It's interesting. So it was a good question. Yay.
Yes, it was a great question.
My other question is, you kind of touched on it a little bit, but what, how were the Irish living pre-Viking invasion? I don't know. Pre-Viking age, I guess.
Yeah. Viking, yes, pre-Viking. We won't say invasion.
I don't think you can say invasion anymore. That's a that you're making a value judgment on that.
Like. Oh, okay, sorry about that. But I get cancelled by Vikingists there.
Yes, you will. So pre-Viking, people are generally living in rural settlements, in farms, all around the countryside. Generally, two or three houses, you know, small family groups in defined settlements. Usually ringforts. Ringforts are the most common form of early medieval settlement, but also unenclosed settlement, settlement cemeteries. The, you know, the amount of, again, the amount of developer-led archaeology that we've seen, we know that there's much greater morphology in settlement. In kind of in what an early medieval settlement looked like, but generally quite small groups of people living together, and usually living in roundhouses, in these post and wattle roundhouses, very much self-sufficient, very much producing food objects for themselves, a little bit, some trading going on, you know, mostly barter exchange. Not a huge amount of contact from, I think, from outside kind of the general, kind of the local area. We have wonderful, wonderful law texts, legal texts, early medieval Irish texts, which tell us a huge amount about kind of the...
A lot about cows, as I remember.
An awful lot about cows.
Cow-based. Yeah.
Cows are very important. Cows are still very important.
There's still some areas of like West Cork and stuff where that's how the law is.
Yeah. But I think what's important to remember about the laws is they're a reflection of the idealized society, what they want society to be like, but not necessarily a reflection of what society actually is. So although we can talk about in great detail about the different types of the people who have permission to travel around the countryside, you know, the wandering smith or the bard or the lawyer, or the poet, whoever, we, you know, that's not to say that other people couldn't travel, but generally the impression is that people didn't travel a great deal. People were kind of stayed close to home in their settlements. Were generally self-reliant, self-sufficient, and although, yeah, I'll leave that there.
So,
yeah.
Would in terms of Irish stories and stuff like that, would they have been past? You said about traveling poets and bards and stuff. That's how they would have gone from, I suppose, settlement to settlement. Then those and been passed down.
Yeah, passed down through the generations.
I love that idea.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, it would have been very similar in Viking Scandinavia as well, North Atlantic. You know, it is an oral tradition of storytelling. And that's how stories are preserved, how the laws are preserved, how everything gets passed on from generation to generation.
Do you think that similarities like that in terms of culture are why there was, I guess, an integration of Vikings and Irish people at that time, that it probably wasn't as much of a clash? Storytelling culture was such a big entertainment factor at the time. And as we know now, entertainment rules everything, pretty much.
Yes. I mean, when you think about it, the initial kind of contact would have been the first couple of generations. And after that, there is this kind of, there are layers of cultural complexities that actually sit quite nicely along each other. So neither Scandinavia nor Ireland was Romanized.
Yeah.
You know, we were both rural societies based around farming, based around subsistence. You know, we weren't urban in the way that places like Italy, Gaul, the Roman Empire was. So there are lots of different... there's lots of different things that kind of butt up against each other, that complement each other in both Ireland and Scandinavia, that would, I think, have been different to England, which was Romanized. And
interesting.
Well, I will jump in here though and say, you're talking about the histories and the what's remembered. The Irish annals are very good for suggesting that from the 8th century that there's a little bit of argy-bargy, at least initially, with Scandinavians. Are in Ireland. I mean, I go say anyone say, if you just read through the annals of Ulster, which is kind of thing that people listen to.
Do the annals of Ulster use the term argy-bargy? Because if they do,
it's pretty cool. After a while, you suspect the scribes have written the heathen slaughtered everybody. There's a while, they're just going to say there was a bit of argy-bargy going on. But you basically get the impression that I get, and say a sort of outsider, but having read through them, you get the sort of standard what you'd expect for a sort of a largely rural sort of heroic sort of society, and this is written from sort of Christian perspective. These annals, kings are dying, queens are dying. It's generally fairly sort of as you would expect, and then suddenly you just get these sort of pot marks of, and then the Gentiles or heathens, whatever, appear. And there's a raid, and they slaughter everyone at an ecclesiastical settlement. And this happens. And then if you look through, if you did a sort of chart, then it goes from dot, dot, dot to everywhere for 50, 60, 70, 80 years. And that's maybe, again, what we'd expect. But then something begins to change. And this is where we're getting towards Rebecca's research, because they start to stay. They start to overwinter, as they do in England and in Scotland, and it's winter camps, as they're sort of known in Britain. And I've asked Stephen Harrison in the past, this many years ago, how to pronounce the plural of Longfjords, but Longfjords?
Longfjords, yes.
Longfjords, okay. Which is kind of like ship, sort of harbour ports, essentially. Yeah, it's using it's sort of Latin that's been borrowed into ecclesiastical sort of Irish sources, and they've come up with this kind of new term to describe something that's a new thing. It's these heathens, these Gentiles, these Scandinavians are staying, and they're staying in these settlements that we know as essentially long ports, essentially these sort of winter overwintering camps. And you can imagine maybe Woodstown's a famous one, just fairly near Waterford is now another later Scandinavian inspired settlement town, but you've got something like Woodstown. So you've got maybe ships pulled up against the river, and you've got maybe potentially some sort of defensive embankment around it, and then you've got maybe several thousand people that are there for a period of time. And you've got things like sort of like these sort of cottage industries, you've got metalworking, you've got, they're probably making sort of fake coins, they're cutting up silver, they're living, they're dying, they're joking, they're playing games, they're planning what they're going to do, they're interacting with the locals, they're probably taking trips, they're probably going out to raid. This era, the Longfjords era, is this the start of urbanism or sort of towns, or is it completely divorced from what comes afterwards? If you could just maybe tell us a little bit about what the Longfjords were, and if there are any relation to this situation that Luke was asking about earlier, the time before, and then this time afterwards, where Woodstown, and then you get Waterford, and then you get whatever's happening in Dublin, maybe around the Blackpool, and then you get what we know now is kind of Dublin or Viking Age Dublin. So could you just introduce us to along Fuhr, is it like a proto town? And does it have any influence on your kind of work in terms of that sort of towns proper, like Dublin and Waterford and Cork?
Yeah. So you gave a really lovely summary there of what a Longford is. So so there are these ship camps. I want to say there's 26 known suspected examples in Ireland, but I could be wrong there. I think
just sound confident. Luke and I will not know.
I'm confident. There are several of these examples, these sorts of sites from across Ireland, from the West Coast down to Waterford, down to Woodstown, right back up to Dublin and around. And they're places. They mark this, as you say, they mark this change in kind of in change in contact, I think, between what happened before, so the period from the 790s to the 840s, where this sporadic contact, and it is raiding, you know, it is violent intention. Violent in intention, it is taking people, taking property, taking goods away and out of circulation, out of Ireland. But then we get to the 840s, and you know, the prime example is, of course, Dublin, where the monks note that they stayed for the winter, they overwintered for the first time, and that they noted this denotes that there is something new and different happening here, and it is a change. So we had spoken a few minutes ago about what the typical Irish settlement was, and I said that there are these, you know, generally small scale settlements, but there were a couple of larger settlements, usually associated with monastic complexes, so places like Clonmacnoise, where there is evidence again for lots of people coming together, living together, on a larger scale than the individual household scale, and I suppose contrasting the Longford, maybe something like the scale of Woodstown to Clonmacnoise, you know, they would be comparable in terms of the numbers of people there, but where we fall down in terms in comparing those to like the later urban places, Dublin, Waterford, is the lack of evidence for houses, for structures, for permanent intentional buildings. And this is something that we come across in Repton, in Arsney. There aren't big intentional structures, big intentional buildings there in these places. They seem perhaps to have used tents, booths, temporary structures, and that fits in with the character of the place, the character of the Longford, as somewhere where you go for a short period of time, you know, for a season, a week, a day, a night, or a slightly longer period of time, a couple of winters, a decade maybe, but they're not intended to be permanent statements in the landscape. They're not intended to be renewed generation after generation, maybe. So are they proto-urban? Are they early urban places? Gareth Williams used a phrase that they have the flavor of urbanism when he was talking about I think it was about Arsney. And that, you know, there are commonalities in the way people lived in Longforts and the commonalities within the way they lived in the later urban, later towns. So things like defined areas for craft production, say, for example, for tanning, you know, because tanning leather is a smelly process. You want that away from where you're living. So there would have been, there is evidence that there were defined production areas, that there were defined areas for probably for keeping animals, for livestock, areas on the edge of the river for the boats, for the boat repair, shipyard areas. And that would be similar to a town in the defined spaces. People would have been living close together in the same kind of close contact that I've been talking about earlier. But are they intended to be permanent in the way that a town becomes permanent? I don't think so. But did they create an environment whereby that jump to permanence happened? Maybe. I think there's overlap. I'm not entirely clear on how and when that happened, but
This is a brilliant chance to actually get into a and away from the long view, because I could talk about them all day. but we can talk about then a case study in Dublin, because you've got two settlement focuses there. You've got the Blackpool and you've got Temple Power West, and different things seem to be happening. So could you maybe just describe what's happening around about 840 plus and around the Blackpool, and you can describe where that is. It's just immediately south of where just where the Chester BT Library is, essentially, yes. Isn't it? Just next to that, south of Dublin Castle. Great library, by the way. If you're interested in that sort of thing. But so you've got, maybe just describe what's happening around the Blackpool, which is what you and your book said, slightly different, what's maybe happening slightly further to the north and Temple Bar West. So you could maybe then meld the two worlds of there's maybe a Longport there, but there's also then something that's got this air of more permanence and structure to it. So if you could maybe just talk about the Blackpool and Temple Bar West.
Yeah. So I think the closest where we come to that is to seeing that overlap is in Dublin itself, where we have these two different sites, South Great George's Street, the Blackpool site, and Temple Bar West, which is just below the river. So these sites were both excavated by Lindsay Simpson. Temple Bar West was excavated in the 1990s, and South Great George's Street, the Blackpool site, about 10 years later, 2003, 2004. And they are two fantastic sites, but really quite different in their character. So the Blackpool, the South Great George's Street site, was very dramatic when it was excavated. It was the subject of a Discovery programme, Discovery Channel TV documentary when it was excavated, because they were, it's located just beside Dublin Castle, just beside the Chester Beatty Library. And they were excavating away there quite happily, going through the layers of post-medieval basements, layers of garden soil. And then they came down to the very earliest levels, right on the edge of the Blackpool, which, of course, the Blackpool, Dublin, the name of Dublin. And they found some Viking burials, furnished burials. So these are the Viking furnished burials, where a warrior has been buried with a sword and spear, you know, his accoutrements of his trade. And these stand out in Irish archaeology because contemporary burials do not have swords and spears. They don't have grave goods. So these stood out as being very different and really exciting. And they did some isotope analysis on the bones. They radiocarbon dated them, and they came in as really early dates, 840s, 830s, 840s. And two of the burials were had isotopic signatures suggesting they came from the North Atlantic, from the Scottish Islands, from potentially from Scandinavia. So for these, and morphologically, these were male graves, male warrior, male, very robust men buried, died in their prime, in their 20s, maybe, quite physically tall, you know, 6 foot tall, very imposing specimens. I'm trying without saying to say they're your very typical Viking warrior, your stereotype of what you think of at that were these guys buried with swords and spears and shields on the edge of the Blackpool in Dublin, with dates of the middle of the ninth century, with this isotopic signature that suggests they'd come from, if not Scandinavia, at least from the North Atlantic. And they're appearing here right on the edge of the Blackpool, which was really exciting. And the grave goods themselves, they're not terribly well preserved. The burials weren't very well preserved because it's the drier soil there, more acidic, less preservation of organic elements. And they're lovely, really nice graves, really nice burials, as I've said. But that's, and they grabbed the attention, they grabbed the headlines there. But I think something that's much more exciting is something that was even less well preserved, but the remains of a rectangular building. In the same levels, the same early 9th century, early 10th century levels. And this building, was preserved as a row of post holes with some cobbled floors, some metal floors, stone floors, and a hearth and some patches of occupation debris. So, you know, just introduced the it introduced the idea that there's a building there associated with these burials. And when I looked at the form and the size of this building, it comes across as a really big rectangular building, really big hall, because it has those rows of posts. It lends itself most clearly to comparisons with Scandinavia and Icelandic longhouses, which are the kind of the typical, the great big house that you think of, like the example, the longhouse at Borg, which is this massive, huge rectangular longhouse. You're nodding like you've seen the pictures of this house. It's huge. Yeah. It's a really, really impressive building. And these are the kind of the ancestral homes of the Vikings. This longhouse, it's really a part of this warrior culture that permeates the Viking Age. And we see this, an echo of this in this rectangular building on the edge of the Blackpool in Dublin, associated with these early warrior burials. Now, our Blackpool example isn't quite as big as the Borg example. It's about, I think, the biggest estimate's about 80 metres in area. It's, you know, it's nowhere near the scale of the biggest Scandinavian examples, but it is much bigger than anything else we find in Dublin, in the Irish landscape at that time. Mm. And it's appearing on the edge of the Blackpool with these warrior burials. It's enclosed within within a ditch and bank, just as you were saying for the Longford examples. And it's a really, I think that we have to interpret it as this whole complex as a real statement of possession, of intention here in Dublin. They're coming along, they're landing, they're pulling their ships in on the edge of the Blackpool. They're placing these really, I suppose, they're votive burials, really definitive statements of Vikingness there on the edge of the Blackpool. With this longhouse. And it's this real statement of possession here. But then if we move just a couple of hundred metres up the road to Temple Bar West, to the site that was excavated earlier in the 90s, we have something very different happening here. So Temple Bar West has dates of the mid to late 9th century. So slightly later than the Blackpool, than these warrior burials. And it's very different. The evidence is very different in nature. There's lots of houses. The earliest houses that appear are these rectangular houses, the ones that we've been talking about with the aisles, and the two doorways, the opposed doorways, the central hearth, the aisled layout. And they appear at the in level 3 in Temple Bar West. And they appear just as they are, and just as they continue to be built 3 centuries later at the end of Fishamble Street, the end of the Viking, kind of the Viking phases of Dublin. And they're smaller. They're not associated with any warrior burials. They're not associated with this big kind of this statement of intention as we see at the Blackpool. They're very much more normal, ordinary houses. They're where, you know, you and I would live. They are the finds that come from them. There's not as many finds as from the later levels, but they're kind of everyday normal finds. You know, there's bits of jewelry, bits of knives, bits of pieces of bone implements, bone tools, you know, normal finds, everyday material that comes out. The find suggests that there were women and children there as well. That there are, so that we're seeing full representative household here, again, in that nuclear family household appearing here in Temple Bar West. And I think that we have a different statement here. We have what here is starting to, what becomes known as the town of Dublin. I think we have this earlier, I've lost my words now. What we have in Temple Bar is the beginnings of what is going to become Dublin, what is going to become the town of Dublin, not the Longford of Dublin. And we need to think again about the relationships between these two sites, between the very different character, the very different nature of evidence at both these sites, and see how do these two places coexist in the same landscape, how they react and respond to each other.
And that's the interesting, I mean, I'll let Luke go next, but you're talking about these sort of two characters coexisting. You've got the Blackpool and you've got the Temple Bar West, which is what we're going to expand on now, this more permanency, this urban. But how then, because people might be thinking, and again, referencing the other burials in Ireland. If you're talking about other burials in Ireland, you're thinking about Kilmainham Island Bridge, yeah, to quite far west. So what relationship do you think, as an urban archaeologist focusing on Dublin, the relationship between, this is really just a personal question, between Kilmainham Island Bridge burials, which again, more of these, you know, if you want to think what a Viking looks like buried, you look at Kilmainham and Iron Bridge, and as you say, the Blackpool. So how do they kind of, do you think, correlate to what's happening in terms of spatially, in terms of chronologically, what's happening in Temple Bar West when this town proper is starting?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's one that's very difficult to answer, though, because geographically there's a big distance between Temple Bar West and Island Bridge. It's a couple of kilometres. You know, they are physically a long way away from each other. And it's one of the, this is an ongoing research question for Dublin. You know, how do these different places all relate to each other? As you know, Kilmainham and Island Bridge were antiquarian finds, antiquarian discoveries, and they didn't, their methods of analysis of excavation were perhaps not quite what we would consider best practice these days. We know that there's lots of missing material from Kilmainham and Island Bridge. There's no skeletal remains. But how did they work together? I don't know. But
it's fine. There's sometimes this is not an interrogation. It's absolutely fine.
But when you go to the annals, right, to the historical sources again, they're talking about hundreds of ships being based in Dublin. Hundreds of ships, hundreds of ships' crews. And this is a point that Paul Holm has made, and that, again, Lindsay Simpson has picked up on in her research framework for Dublin. You know, physically, if you have hundreds of ships and hundreds of ships' crews with, you know, a crew is what, 40, 50, 60 men, and hundreds of crews, where do these people all fit? So do we need to really expand out our, where we're looking for 9th century, 9th and 10th century Dublin? Do we need to look again at the north side of the river? We need at the space between Temple Bar and Kilmainham, because where are these people?
A bit like you were discussing Repton earlier, and sort of Kat Jarman, but I've worked on the dig at Repton and at Foremark, and Foremark's again a few sort of kilometres down the river, but still along that river. And there's this idea that there's these winter camps overwinting are over a huge area, like Annagassan, enormous. Yes. But even the bits that we know about, there's the other side of the river they're at, they're slightly further up the river valley. So absolutely. We won't press you on that, apart from we clearly just need more developer-led archaeology in Dublin. If clients out there are listening, you know, we're ready to go.
I suppose moving on to talking about the urban sites in Ireland, would they have been influenced by other towns? I was going to name some towns, but I will butcher the pronunciation. So let's do it, just so people can be annoyed. Kaupang?
Yeah.
Yeah. Birka?
Yeah.
Ribe?
Niba. You're close.
I was kind of going 50-50 on that one. Njörvik.
And Njörvik, yes.
Yeah. Would it be influenced by those?
There is definitely influence. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, going on. So what we're talking about here, these four sites. So Njörvik is York in England, whose archaeology is 10th century. Mm-hmm. So after Dublin. But then Riba and Kaupang. Riba is in Denmark, and its archaeology starts in the 7th century. So it's urban archaeology starts in the 7th century. And then Kaupang in Norway, it's just south of Oslo. And we're talking about 8th, 9th century there. And then Birka is on the east coast of Sweden. And it's 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th century. So these are different sites on the time frame and the continuum. So there has to be, and we can look at the material culture, at the hoards, at what the artifacts are found in them, and we can see that there are definitely correlations between them. There is ongoing influence backwards and forwards across these sites, across the time frame. In terms of the houses, because the houses is what I look at, it's a little bit harder to say. But there is definitely the same sort of house, this urban post and wattle house with the internal freestanding roof supporting posts that turns up in the 8th century in Riba, in the early late 8th century, early 9th century in Kaupang. And then we see it appearing in Templebar West in the second half of the 9th century in Dublin. These are essentially the same houses. They look the same morphologically. The Riba and Kaupang examples might be a little bit bigger, physically bigger, but it's the same sort of house. It's the post and wattle walls, the central hearth, the aisle divisions. So then the bigger question then is, where does it come from in Riba, in the earlier contexts? How does it emerge there? And that's something that we're looking at the moment with Sarah Croix. Looking at kind of the connections between these houses, between the traditions that are evident in these three different settlements. But when we come to Njörvik, it's a little bit different when we come to York, because again, and I'll come back again to the difference between a round house and a rectangular house is corners. And I've said that our doorways in the Dublin houses are in the middle of the end walls. And that's structurally, that's something that we need to see here for the house to work, for the weight of the roof to be supported on the house. But when we go to Njörvik in those, the layer of post and wattle housing that looks similar to our Dublin house. So it's rectangular. It's the same kind of size. It's the post and wattle construction and the central hearth. But the doorway in the Njörvik houses is located in the corner of the end wall rather than the middle. And structurally, that has an impact on the construction of the building, on the way the weight of the roof is distributed through the walls. But it also has an impact on how you think about moving through the house. So like I said, the doorway in the middle of the wall, you know, it guides your attention to it. You look right through it, right into the middle of the house and out to the back of the house. But if you have the doorway in the corner, it means that when you enter the house, you have to consciously turn to see the whole house. So part of the house it's almost hidden as soon as you enter into the doorway. It doesn't have the same impact. So I think there is something different going on there. I'm not sure where it comes from. I'm not sure how it feeds in here. If it's a structural difference, it's obviously a structural difference, but where it comes from, because of course in Njörvik as well, we don't have the full length of the houses. So we don't have the other end of the house to see if there was a matching paired doorway there in the other end wall. And if there was, then we can have the same kind of conversation about moving through the house into the property, into the out through the house into the other end of the property, into the other yard. But if there wasn't a matching doorway in the other wall, then these houses become quite different in terms of spaces, in terms of how you move into them. And basically, they're dead ends. So they're much more private spaces if there isn't a second doorway. So it's something that I'm working on, that I'm thinking about. But there are some differences as well as similarities between the houses in all these sites.
What then would a house have to be classified as, like a Hiberno Norse type house?
Okay. So
the type one, we're in the type one,
yeah, the type era one
of this podcast now. We're getting into the really good stuff.
Into the really nitty gritty. So the Hiberno Norse building typology is a typology that was developed during the 1980s by Pat Wallace. And he basically took all the houses that had been excavated in Dublin to that point and looked at the similarities between them, the differences, and said that you can classify them into these five different types of houses. So the type one house is the main house, the big house. And it is that post and wattle, rectangular, roof supporting posts, paired doorways, central hearth.
What sort of dimensions are we talking, just to get people an idea of like width and length roughly?
Yeah, not very big. So dimensions, they're about 40 squared meters. So about, what's that? The numbers have disappeared now from my head. But you know,
it's like 5 meters
by eight,
something like that. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So five large paces to get the width and eight or so to get the, okay. So yeah, it's not tiny, but you know, like, a couple of large rooms in modern terms.
Yeah. Kind of like a one bed apartment, you know, they're not very big. When I looked at it, they came in under the size of what the Department for Housing qualified as a studio apartment.
So they're not big.
And you're thinking you're living there with your whole family, your whole household.
And what would the numbers of a household be then? Is there an average?
There is not an average.
Okay.
That's one of the kind of pitfalls here. You know, what size is your household? So what I said in the start was we generally think about these as being kind of nuclear family types of households. Yeah. So your parents, couple of children, probably a couple of grandparents, an unmarried sibling, perhaps an apprentice or a foster child.
Huh.
You know, but they don't seem to be the massive multi-generational families that we see perhaps in Scandinavia at this point. So where there's lots of different people living together. So sure, parents and children and grandparents, but also lots of potential for a retinue, for retainers. Obviously talking about the more elite end of the spectrum there. But again, we're not talking about agricultural households. So we're not talking about people that having servants or slaves, enslaved people to look after crops, to tend to the fields, to do physical labor like that. Or are we? You know, that's a whole other question. The idea of how we investigate for the presence of enslaved people in these urban places. But we're generally talking about households that you and I would recognize as a household. Partly because the houses themselves, the spaces themselves are quite small. So when you try and think about the maximum number of people who can live comfortably in a studio apartment, you know, you're not talking about a huge household.
So what you're saying is they purposely chose smaller houses to make sure people can go away.
Possibly.
you don't have to stay here anymore. Go to your own place.
Go find your own house.
Yeah, exactly.
But then, you know, that brings up, how do you establish a new house? A new household. Where do you get the land from? Where does the property come from? Who invests in the materials to build a house?
It's an interesting perspective because you look at pictures of the sort of poverty in Glasgow in the 19th century up until probably at least the First World War, and you get things known as single ends, which are nowadays called studio apartments or literally one room apartments, and you had 8, 9, 10 people living in them. So I imagine if you'd had this discussion 100 years ago in cities in Britain and Ireland, people would have gone, oh yeah, like grandparents and eight of us all living in one room is like, it's not great, but it's kind of like, we all know someone who's in that scenario.
Yeah. Yeah. And that feeds back into our modern perceptions of what is and isn't acceptable. And, you know, we need to think again about what's about the detail and the nitty gritty of what the household could actually be. How many people, kind of, how do we quantify it? And of course, the other thing in the Viking Age is that the household members could very easily be away traveling, whether they're raiding or trading, you know, so you have to allow for the presence of people who are part of that household, but who are not physically present within the household as well.
Because you get that at Birka, don't you? You get, well, it's more in the burial evidence, but you get this women and children often buried with like items related to trade goods, which is kind of my area of things. And that seems to be, you know, there's this idea that, you know, when the men or whoever, you know, are meant to be away doing all this stuff, that, you know, the business is run because you need to invest for the next one and you need to plan for the next one. You need to build up stock and you need to essentially make credit arrangements, so when the ship comes back, it can be repaired and things like that. So yeah, even if people are away, there's still probably work going on. And it's, yeah, it's sort of genderless probably at that time, because people are just having to do, you know, because someone dies and you just like, oh, we have to take over this import export business, or we have to take over making woodcraft or amber jewelry. So I imagine it's probably quite a messy scenario in a sense that it's not really defined very clearly even at the time.
Yeah, I think fluid, changeable. And that's not even allowing for things like, you know, natural disasters, the house burning down, the accidents happen. And then the immediate changes that would have on the household, or, you know, terrible scenario, the house burns down, the family is inside it. So who gets that land then? Who can appropriate
that? Was one of my questions. Yeah. What because you've seen houses that maybe have burnt down, and then are they often or built upon again? Because they're essentially, they're made of everything that can burn. Everything in them can burn and wants to burn. So it must have, I'm surprised that, you know, and they're cheek by jowl, aren't they? They're often almost touching, if
they're
not
like
actually touching.
So houses.
And
we do see that there are events, particularly on Fishamble Street, where, you know, where the houses burn down, where the adjoining houses burn down. And actually there's wonderful work by the late Eileen Riley coming out soon. So she looked at the insect assemblages from some of the Fishamble Street houses, and she could tell that, you know, in this level, this house was occupied by people, because the insect signature is of active human occupation. But then in the next level, you can tell that she could tell that the house had been abandoned and that there were pigs in the property, using the property, you know, rooting around, because, you know, there were lice, fleas, whatever particular insect signature that pigs have, were there. But then in the next level after that, it goes back to human occupation. So the property is left fallow for a level, for a decade, a generation, whatever we define a level as being, and is used, it is colonized by pigs. So who owns the pigs? Where do they come from?
Yeah.
Are they just rooting around wild? Does anybody own them? And, you know, there's loads of, yeah, there's all these different threads to pull at there, and the changes in generation. And that's the wonderful detail of this archaeology, that we could talk about changes on that sort of level, in that sort of scale and detail.
You mentioned something interesting a minute ago of social norms, and now social norms nowadays compared to then. How often, I guess this is a question for both of you, how often in writing a book like this or researching these things do you have to check yourself and your own social norms in how you think about something and interact with the information you're given?
All the time.
I'd imagine so.
All the time. It's really hard. It's really hard to combat that. I don't know. Do you want to come in on that, Tom?
I honestly, it was only because I've seen it's not in the questions we prepared. It was only having this conversation with you now and what you were just saying that I had this image of, there's amazing sort of photographs taken by Glasgow City Council you know, assessing poverty. Actually, a lot of time, East End of Glasgow, where half my family are from, there's a lot of Irish immigrants there from the 1840s, and everyone was like shoved together in these tiny single ends. That made me think of that, and then thinking it's terrible, but you know, my great great grandparents, you know, maybe coming over from Ireland and whatever, great 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 grandparents, they would have all lived together, multi generational, probably maybe doing some crafts to get some extra money at the time as well. And I'm thinking about that, and I wasn't thinking about that 10 minutes ago, never mind, you know, yeah. This year. So I think it really does. Yeah, the more you talk about it, it's great, these podcasts and chatting with other academics, that your brain just makes these connections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess we're going to come towards the end of... jump in there.
Well, I was actually just going to come back to the idea of the household and say that it's something that I'm really struggling with at the moment. How to investigate the household without imposing our own modern conceptions on it? And I keep talking about the nuclear family, and I talk a lot about the parent-child relationship, but partly that's because that is so founded in kind of in the patriarchy. We'll go there. We'll talk about feminist archaeology. It's what we know. It's what we acknowledge. It's what we recognize, particularly here, because the church and its ideal of the two-parent-child family is what was accepted. And that comes down through us in so many different levels, not least because a lot of the comparative work here comes from the textual sources, you know, the legal text talking about what is a family, and you know, the different, you know, that a woman could file for divorce on the 29th of February, you know, on the leap year, because it was just the leap year there. So that was that's topical. But again, you know, that's imposed values from the church teachings. That's not reflective of necessarily of what's going on. And that comes down through the text. It's also, you know, it's baked into us, and it's baked into the scholars who are the ones who translated these texts during the 19th and 20th century. So we have to peel back through their layers of accepted social norms and assumed social norms as well. So it becomes... the more I think about this, the more difficult it is to get at what was a Viking household, what was an urban household, because there are so many different layers to peel back. And that's not even going anywhere near the idea of kind of intersectional perspectives and the idea that a person can have competing and conflicting identities and beliefs all at the same time. So it's really, really complex. And I do sometimes feel as if I'm doing the idea of the household a complete disservice by saying it's just the nuclear family, the heteronormative parent-child relationships. I think it's much, much more difficult than that.
I think, yeah, I mean, the shindig is that, you know, we started off this discussion, we didn't know it was going to go here. And I'm here for that, because again, it's making me think about household archaeology in the first place. And you know, as much as guilty of anyone, I'll look at it, and if there's something to do with the trade stuff I look at, I'll take that out and then I'll run away with it and I don't consider this sort of house around it. But the one thing, I mean, maybe Luke will have a couple of questions or a question after, but just to sort of take us back to the house, at one areas of your research that I was particularly interested in reading your excellent book, and we'll plug that at the end as well, is that what are we looking at? Is the type one house, this is this sort of house that's there from the 9th to the 12th century, it doesn't really change too much. It's a kind of fusion, as I understand it from reading it, I probably mistook it, but it's a fusion of sort of, there's Irish elements, there's Scandinavian elements, but in terms of its zoning, it's kind of a little bit more Scandinavian in the sense that it's rectangular. It's got, you talk about a deep and narrow, I had to look at my notes, deep and narrow spatial layout, which is again different from the round house. You've got maybe a hearth in the center. It could be stone lined. In very rare examples, you maybe get foundation deposits like the animal skull in the center of it. So is it kind of very crudely, is it sort of 75% Scandinavian influence and 25% Irish, or, I mean, that's obviously nonsense, but just imagine I didn't say that. But just to get an idea of if someone's going into this house and just, you know, where the influences are coming from. And if that's a question.
Yes, it is a question. it is. I suppose I started off the work a long time ago thinking that I could quantify it like that, you know, say it's more Irish or more Scandinavian. And I looked at the houses and then I came back to them after a period of years and looked again and started, you know, questioning myself the way we all do. And I think there are a couple of examples of houses that stand out as being different from the majority of the material. And that's houses like FS 88 from Fishamble Street, which is, you know, which is the richest example of houses. It's the most well constructed. It's got the greatest number of artifacts. They're all quite nice artifacts. So it stands out as being really different. There's another house, I think it's FS 10 from Fishamble Street, which stands out because it has three doorways instead of two, which is really odd. But it's a very early house. It's from the second level of housing in Fishamble Street. So it's early 10th century. And then there's a couple of other houses that have, as you said, that have these foundation deposits of animal skulls buried below the hearth. And those animal skull deposits are very Scandinavian. It's something that it's common in Scandinavia. It is not here. It just isn't. But those particular houses, those particular animal skull deposits, I think are really fascinating because they're quite late in the chronology. They're later 10th century. And they're made in the foundation levels of the house rather than as part of the occupation levels. So I wonder, you know, could we think of this as a very obvious statement of Vikingness, of Scandinavian identity in what is by that stage a Christianized community, Christian Dublin. And if they're made in the foundation levels, that means that, you know, there's no construction on site. So are these made out in the open, in the as obvious, not donations, obvious deposits for other people to see? Or is this something that's hidden away? That happens, you know, under cover of night in this stage with nobody else around, nobody else to see. We will never know the answers to that. But it's really, I think the fact that these particular houses, these deposits are in the later periods in Christianized Dublin, in Christian contexts, is really interesting to talk about the interactions there between the Viking and the Irish. In terms of the rest of the houses, the majority of them, so like I said, I started off thinking I could say that they were more Viking, more Irish. And I think what I've come to is that they're neither, that I've come back around to the idea of this Hiberno-Norse identity. So which is, you know, Hiberno-Norse is the term phrased by John Bradley, that it's elements of both Viking and Irish coming together. And you'll never be able to pull them apart. You'll never be able to say what is more Irish or more Scandinavian because they're just so mingled together. And when I came back to the houses, to me, it almost feels it's more important to say that they're part of this urban environment, this urban experience, rather than being one or the other, because they're just so similar. It's the same construction style, same post and wattle construction for centuries. And it's the same construction style that was used, continued to be used in Ireland for centuries. But we know from Reba, from Kaupang, that post and wattle was also used in these urban places, in the earliest houses. So it seems to be an accepted construction style that works in these environments. And then because we're talking about, you know, not narrow, but small congested spaces, you know, space is at a premium. So we're talking about rectangular houses because that's what works. You know, you build rectangular houses because you can fit more houses into the space. It's a very practical choice. And if you think about the earlier levels, the 9th, 10th century levels, there has to have been a lot of tension there. you know, between the kind of the Scandinavian-ness and the local Irishness, you know, and how do you kind of merge? How do the two sides come together? How do they come together in this new environment and merge into creating this new Hiberno Norse identity? And I think it's from this that the idea of these being urban houses rather than typically Viking or typically Irish comes together, because you need to create a new environment where everyone can coexist and come together. And they made some practical choices about the construction style and the shape of the building, because it's what works in this urban environment. And the argument I made was that by creating this and consciously choosing this type of post and wattle architecture, this accepted streetscape of all the houses being the same, you create a kind of level playing field. And this comes out a little bit in migration theory, that when you get two cultures coming together in this new environment, that they just kind of meld together to create this external view of what's accepted, what's socially accepted, to create a common environment where everyone can thrive. And then we have this kind of this external street front where everyone is together, but inside in the houses you can have more variety, you can express your personal identity, perhaps express that slight Scandinavianness or that slight Irishness or neither. But it's about creating this urban environment, this urban architecture to structure this new urban world.
I think that's perfect. I mean, that's one of my favorite answers, I think. I have nothing else to add apart from saying thank you. That was one of my favorites. I think the only reason we have to stop is because Luke will tell me to stop, because we'll run out of internet, I think. But that was fantastic. And a lot, so much to think about. And yeah, as we were discussing earlier, it's making us think even on the hoof here. So thank you very much, Rebecca.
No, thank you. It's been really enjoyable.
Yeah. Before we go, give a little bit of a plug for your book. Tell the people what it is, where they can get it, all that kind of good information.
All that good information, yes. My new book, I have it right here. Ooh. It's a lovely cover picture. And this is actually the picture of the house on the Blackpool that I was talking about at the start. It's this wonderful reconstruction drawing by Simon Dick, who was one of the archaeologists who actually excavated the house. And it's just, it's one of my favorite images. But the book is called Exploring Ireland's Viking Age Houses, Viking Age Towns, Houses and Homes. And it was published last year by Routledge in their Archaeologies of the Viking World series, where Tom also has an excellent volume and some other wonderful work there. And yeah, you can buy it from the publisher. I will also be having a launch in Dublin in April, where I think we will have a nice discount on offer if anyone is around in Dublin. Yes.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much. And it just remains for us, on behalf of the Red River Archaeology Group and the Shindig, thank you very much, Rebecca Boyd.
Thank you.
Well, I think we didn't undersell it, and I think it absolutely delivered that podcast. We couldn't stop talking about Viking homes at the end, and you and I knew relatively little about Viking homes at the beginning.
That's the thing. I love when you get an engaging guest like that on, who's able to draw you in with the stories and able to draw you in with it. That's the real, I suppose, telltale sign of a good storyteller, effectively. And that's exactly what Rebecca is.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've said it. You know, you start thinking of this sort of modern parallels of the sort of single ends in Glasgow and in the Victorian Edwardian periods, and you start, so any podcast like that that makes you think, oh, that's a little bit like this, it's a little bit like that, and draw in historical parallels. I think that's doing the job, I think.
Yep, I think this one was fantastic. Another one for the record books. We have some good ones coming up as well. So stay tuned to the Shindig. Make sure you hit that subscribe button, hit that follow.
And before you do that, be aware, we think this is going out on a Tuesday, before the Friday, the 5th of April, 2024. And Rebecca is having a book launch of her book. With a good friend of mine, Stephen Harrison. And I think there are details of that on line, and that's going to be in Dublin, 6 p.m. Friday, April the 5th, and 56 to 58 Dawson Street. So
if you enjoyed the podcast, go along, support that. It's definitely well worth popping along to. As I say, if you enjoyed this, you'll definitely enjoy that. And if you enjoyed this, as we were saying, give us a like, give us a follow, give us a subscribe, leave us a rating, leave us a review. Let us know what you enjoyed about this episode. Leave some comments underneath us on YouTube. Send us some messages on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook. We love hearing from people who are listening and watching The Shindig. And we'd love to hear your views on what you'd like to hear coming up in the future, because we have some phenomenal guests lined up and already in the can for you right here on The Shindig.
Thank you very much.